Hey, hey, and welcome. I'm Dave, and you are listening to Life is Peachy, a nostalgia-fueled podcast that allows me to sit here and waffle on about the bands and albums that became the soundtrack to my life. Growing up in the 90s, the early 2000s, and while we're at it, sharing a few memories from Her Name is Murder Productions. Heading into the mid-2000s, as a lot of new metal was moving towards a more rockier, radio-friendly arc, I found myself searching through the vast library of sounds and genres in pursuit of new, aggressive, emotional music. I was in dire need of something far more raw and reminiscent of what I felt during the mid-90s. Something that could keep that primal feeling inside of me active and burning bright. In my eyes, nu metal hit some sort of peak in the early 2000s, and as the tides were turning, many bands were forced a make-or-break evolution card with only the strong surviving.
Flawless victory.
I want some more.
And those that did it well and arguably authentically, while somehow maintaining most of their key attributes, are definitely still here today on a massive scale. Deftones, Korn, Papa Roach, for example. Yet, for the most part, many would never again reach the heights of success experienced safe and securely within that nu metal bubble.
If you think I take pleasure in exiling you, you're wrong.
And once that ecosystem started showing signs of wear and tear in the early to mid-2000s, unfortunately, a lot of bands fell through the cracks when it eventually burst completely, and nu metal became a dirty word for the next 15 years or so.
I gave 18 years of my life to stand in the same spot as you! Don't you think I ever wanted other things? Don't you think I had dreams and hopes? What about my life? What about me?
Post-hardcore definitely delivered this much-needed, hard-on-my-sleeve emotion that first attracted me to nu metal throughout the 90s, especially stuff from early Funeral for a Friend and releases from bands like Finch, A Static Lullaby, Hope's Fall, From First to Last, Dance Gavin Dance, Drop Dead Gorgeous, and The Used, their perfect self-titled major label debut, just to name a few. Godfather of nu metal himself, Ross Robinson, would even produce with both Drop Dead Gorgeous on their avant-garde Worse Than a Fairy Tale, The Canyon by The Used, and one of my all-time favourites, From First to Last sophomore, Heroin. With the album's bass tracks performed by none other than Wes Borland.
Have done this for the sake of you.
releases like Wise and the concept of breathing from A Skylit Drive, Escape the Fates, Dying is Your Latest Fashion, Emma Ross's glorious Johnny Craig-fronted Relativity, Page Avenue from Story of the Year, and Sayerson's debut would further add immense, rich color and texture to the genre, similar to the brightness introduced into nu metal coming into the turn of the century. Genre, there definitely was a lot here for me to play with, and it felt so stimulating compared to a lot of bands from the nu metal scene who had started to somewhat water down their sound. I've gone ahead and made a post-hardcore playlist over on the Life is Peachy YouTube, which includes a collection of my favorite tracks and music videos from this era.
Sell crazy someplace else. We're all stocked up here.
Yet as the years continued to move on, I still needed more. A lot of my favorite parts from these post-hardcore bands was highlighted in their use of drastic fight or flight screaming, great riffing, and breakdowns. Around this time, I was going to a lot of shows and enjoying the energy of the pit and having a dance. And by the mid-2000s, metalcore had well and truly moved to the forefront of the scene thanks to releases like Killswitch Engage's 2004 sophomore, The End of Heartache. These bands, even crossing over with artists like The Used, Story of the Year, and Funeral for a Friend for tours such as The Taste of Chaos, bringing together post-hardcore and metalcore on the same bill for an amazing touring festival. So it was now impossible to ignore metalcore, and I have to say I was definitely swept up in the mania of the breakdown and the fine art of throwing down. And for a good stint of time, this was the band-aid for what was missing in my music. This is the last chance you get. Gene, Every Time I Die, Parkway Drive, The Devil Wears Prada, The Tony Danza Tap Dance Extravaganza, Bring Me the Horizon, Guerrilla Estates, Immua, I Set My Friends on Fire, The Bled, Spitfire, Scarlet, The Agony Scene, Attack Attack, The Chariot, Bleeding Through, Unearth, August Burns Red, Under Oath.
Get on with the ceremony!
You get the idea. Australia was no exception to the exploding metalcore market, with bands like Parkway Drive, The Amity Affliction, Wish for Wings, The Red Shore, and I Killed the Prom Queen leading the charge. The front of the pack was Parkway Drive and Prom Queen. And I definitely mean no disrespect, and I know as an Aussie I probably shouldn't say this, but the only problem was I unfortunately just wasn't really a fan of the later, in particular the sound of vocalist Michael Crafter. I could never really connect with I Killed the Prom Queen because I just found Crafter's voice too distracting, and in my personal opinion, it just seemed to bring down the overall experience of listening to their music. So as I pushed on with my search for the ultimate breakdown, Crafter and company were left behind.
Some motherfuckers are always trying to ice skate uphill.
On the 17th of August 2006, my buddies and I arrived at the arena in Brisbane to see Killswitch Engage, Lamb of God, and Unearth. Opening the show was none other than I Kill the Prom Queen. Yet, as none of us were really that into them, the plan was to arrive by the end of their set to then catch Unearth. And so with Prom Queen's much-hyped sophomore, Music for the Recently Deceased, having just dropped a few months prior, even peaking within the top 30 on the ARIA music charts, I had heard along the grapevine that they were now actually with a new vocalist, an Englishman by the name of Ed Butcher. But I still had not come around to looking into this, and was I soon to learn just how much I had been missing out.
The greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he didn't exist.
I'll never forget the moment, walking through the venue entrance and into the concert. I Kill the Prom Queen were quite literally performing the last song of their set, which I would later come to know as their song Like Nails to a Casket. And as the final breakdown was playing out, intertwined with the power of Ed's voice, wow. I stopped dead in my tracks and watched on, glued to what was playing out in front of me. I couldn't move. It was love at first sight. So wait, this was what Prom Queen now sounded like? This was amazing. This was glorious. The band's energy on stage was insane, and front and center of it all stood Ed, his voice filling the room, sounding like nothing else. This was a sound that made sense completely. Music for the Recently Deceased is a bona fide metalcore classic, and as amazing as it is musically, I would still very much argue that the album would not be the beauty it is without Ed Butcher. I would also continue to argue that at the time, he was one of the best aggressive vocalists out there, and it was this substance that completely lifted the band's sound and presented them as an international contender. Now armed with a frontman that seemed like the perfect missing piece to the puzzle, and arguably a piece that was never really again replaced, Prom Queen seemed like they were naturally going to head off with a one-way ticket towards world domination. But within a year, Ed was out, and Prom Queen would go on to call it a day soon after in 2007. Crafter would return to the scene with his new band Confession. Founder and guitarist Jonah Weinhoffen would go on to join Bleeding Through for their album Declaration, and soon after became an official member of Bring Me the Horizon for the There Is a Hell, Believe Me, I've Seen It, There Is a Heaven, Let's Keep It a Secret cycle. Drummer JJ Peters would form D's Nuts with bassist Sean Kennedy, and Kevin Cameron delivered the goods with In Trenches. And even though Prom Queen would continue to reform and reunite over the years with Crafter, and even go on to release new material with another vocalist in 2014, like with a lot of breakups, a line in the sand can sometimes be drawn, and I followed Ed Butcher as he returned to the UK to join Eternal Lord. So looking back, I can see what you mean. A band that would add a itself to my top tier list of metalcore alumni I was throwing down to throughout the 2000s. And here we are in 2023, their album Blessed Be This Nightmare turns 15. As a fan of what Ed brought to Prom Queen, this voice expanded and evolved to the next level with Eternal Lord, accompanied by ferocious musicianship performed by a band all bringing their A game. With their 2008 album debut in their back pocket, the gates to taking on the world had well and truly burst open. But once again, the highs were short, and Eternal Lord would say goodbye that very same year. And from here, it seemed like Ed Butcher fell between the cracks and disappeared from music. And although we had his voice forever imprinted and two amazing releases from either side of the world, I always wondered what had happened to the man responsible for making me fall in love with metalcore in a way that had never hit before. And so it's absolutely amazing that I get to say this out loud. Ed Butcher joins episode 23 of the Life is Peachy podcast to celebrate 15 years of Eternal Lord's Blessed Be This Nightmare and look back on his career as one of the leaders of the scene at a time when breakdowns were king and vocals were cutting the air like razors. Ed, thank you for your time and energy and welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Absolute pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks for making the time. How you feeling today, man?
I'm good, man. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. I have the family dog with me at the moment, so he and I are having a boys' weekend.
I've got my little dog next to me as well, so.
Oh, nice, man. Yeah. They're amazing company, that's for sure.
Yeah, they definitely are. They definitely are.
Well, man, I have to say this is already somewhat of a trip out for me. I don't think I have ever heard your actual speaking voice before. I only know you on recording, so this is surreal to finally hear your...
speaking voice.
Yeah. You're not yelling at me, so... All right, I really love to lay some foundations with each guest on the podcast before we deep dive into the album of discussion. And cool. When it comes to your vocals, I have always been really curious about the origins of your voice.
Wicked.
When you were younger and you were first discovering music on your own terms, was there a particular moment for you when you really noticed voice or vocals?
So it was probably from like a really, really young age. I've been playing guitar since I was 8 years old, I think, when my mum and dad first bought me a guitar and got me into guitar lessons and things like that. And I've got an older brother, and he was always into bands like Nirvana, Guns N' Roses, good old rock bands. And I think that probably gave me a foot on the ladder in some ways, probably from such an early age. I mean, just hearing people like Kurt Cobain and things like that probably set me along that path. But I guess sort of noticing it more probably when I started my own bands when I was in school.
Right.
Yeah, just leading on to sort of heavier bands first, you know, Glassjaw, the first early sort of Norma Jean stuff.
What? Did we just become best friends?
Yep.
When I get back!
I mean, I was never supposed to be a vocalist. I never wanted to be a vocalist. I was always about playing guitar. And it was only when I started my first serious band, The Hunt for Ida Wave, that I was scouting around for other guys to write music with. Of the guys that I was working with at the time were both guitarists, both into the same kind of music. So I was kind of like, well, I've written these songs, let's see how it sounds. Got a drummer, And before I knew it, I'd done myself out of being in my own band. I was like, well, yeah. I'll just pick up a microphone and see if I could at least make something sound how I can envision it. That way we can get something recorded and then try and figure out the rest from there. Nice. And yeah, it kind of just came out, really.
So it was completely incidental.
Yeah, and completely accidental.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was used to just everything from sort of listening to punk bands and swinging a guitar around my head. That was my thing, really. It was purely accidental.
And just on a little side note, Glassjaw in particular, everything you've ever wanted to know about Silence is definitely a game-changing album for me.
Yeah. I remember the first time sitting and listening to that album in my bedroom on my own. And the first time I heard it, I was like, oh, I don't know if I get it or not. I don't know if I get this. Mm-hmm. I remember being so close to thinking, I think I'm going to take this back to HMV. I remember grabbing it on a lunch break from work. And I remember thinking, I think I'm going to take this back and get another Drive-Thru Records album or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I gave it another listen and I was like, yeah, okay, I completely get this.
So happy that happened for you second time around.
Definitely.
The emotion on that album is just on another level.
Oh, yeah.
So, falling into the role of vocalist incidentally, and as you said, to get things moving forward and get that recording done, in those early stages, how did you practice and work on your sound and technique?
Start the music.
I was probably then heavily listening to early Dead to Fall stuff, then things like, again, the first Norma Jean album, Converge, and I was taken by the low vocals, bands like Dead to Fall, Remembering Never. So I remember sort of having quite a naturally low scream anyway, and quite a gnarly scream rather than a sort of high-pitched, shrieky vocal. So I thought I'd just work on that and go in that kind of direction, really. But to be honest, the first couple of times, obviously it shreds everyone's throat to pieces and you think, oh my God, you just end up coughing and drinking 5 litres of water. I just remember thinking, I'm just going to make it as comfortable as I can for myself whilst I'm doing this temporarily. And yeah, that's just what came out, really.
Who did this to you?
You did.
My mind is kind of being blown at this stage. So can we quickly talk more about your first main band and that actual lead up to the hunt for Ida Wave?
I was in bands when I was at school. At the time, our parents paid for us to go into a local recording studio and we wrote a couple of original songs. And then you end up feeling like a celebrity at school and all the rest of it. But we weren't even legally of the age to be in pubs, but we used to sort of play the pub circuit in our local town and things like that. But when I left school, the Hunt for Ida Wave was the first sort of serious band, which was all original music. The first band that got signed and the first band that I toured with.
That's cool.
Yeah, really cool.
Considering you envisioned yourself as a guitarist, what was it like for you to not only make that transition to vocalist, but to frontman for a band and furthermore to perform live?
Yeah, weird and definitely a push out of my comfort zone. I've never been a guy filled with confidence and I've never been a guy with a like huge circle of friends or anything like that really. So it was surreal, and I guess taking myself way out of my own comfort zone. But again, as soon as that adrenaline hits you and you start thinking about what you wrote those lyrics about or a time that made you feel a certain way, then the energy of the music just completely takes over. And essentially, it just becomes somebody else.
So you've just touched on something I find very interesting in saying something like that. Would you say it's going into another character of yourself, tapping into an alter ego or another version?
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe a mixture of both. Yeah, I'm not the type of guy to want to stand and talk in front of 10 people. You know, if you told me I'd have to get up on a stage and talk to thousands of people, that just wouldn't be me at all. So without the music, yeah.
I love that, man. Yeah, it does something similar for me. Music is so powerful.
Oh, so powerful.
Yeah, I've just always found it so interesting, the ability music has to give you this sense of voice or identity, even confidence.
Yeah.
There's so many different shades to it, but it's definitely one of the most powerful assets we have out there, ready and available 24/7 at our fingertips. And the connection and community that can come with it is also something really, really nice.
100%.
Music's one of those lovely things where you can have a journey with it that is both personal and collective. So no matter what, it has this positive impact on your life, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
There can be only one.
The whole thing, I think it's sick. Before we get stuck into Eternal Lord, I'd love to talk a little bit about you trekking to the other side of the world and your time in Australia. For those Aussie listeners hanging out with us right now that would have discovered you through Prom Queen, just like myself.
Please do, that'd be cool.
Nice. What memories do you have of Australia and the fans?
Oh man, Australia is a country. Oh my God, it's just beautiful. Each city for different things and different reasons, really. And 95-98% of the people that I met over there were just so friendly and just genuinely lovely people.
My name is Dale Kerrigan, and this is my story.
The scene over there is really cool. I get excited when I have mates bands over here in the UK that are heading over there on tour and stuff like that. I get excited for them to be able to go and experience what it is and what it's all about over there. Some of the Australian bands now are absolutely killer as well. To this day, I still speak to a few people over there. In that respect, fond memories.
Did you feel like you were accepted by the Australian fans at the time, you know, considering the position you were stepping into?
Yeah, I think so. It was a big change. I tried to stay out of the politics of it all as much as possible. I was just like, hey, ultimately, I've been brought over here to do a job and I'm just going to tuck down and get on with what I'm doing. Obviously, there was some animosity from previous singer and that kind of thing. Nothing was my doing or my decision. I was just brought in as the front man again to get them to sort of a different platform and a new level of record label and recognition for what they wanted, really.
It will be mine. Oh, yes. It will be mine.
Yeah, it's this strange, strange topic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess the more I say about that band, even though for me things are factual, I guess it sounds like I'm bagging on them or slagging them off, and I just haven't got any feelings or energy for any kind of thing like that for them, really.
Well, if I can say selfishly, the good thing to come out of that entire experience was that it introduced you to myself and a bunch of Australians and allowed us to then continue supporting and following you and your career.
Awesome.
Hopefully that's one positive to come out of the whole thing.
Thank you so much. It's mind-blowing that people still follow me. It's just great. And yeah, I was grateful to be given that opportunity. It's one thing I definitely am grateful for. Got a lot of time for Australia, the music scene over there, and just Australian people in general, just so welcoming and friendly. It was a cool time, despite the way it sort of went.
With regards to what you mentioned, that aspect of the band hoping to achieve a new platform, a new level, or whatever, yeah, I quite confidently say that you did exactly that for them. I definitely feel that anyway. I mean, having you in the band was the best thing that ever happened to them, in my opinion.
I get told that quite a lot.
Well, that's amazing to hear, and it also doesn't surprise me one bit.
And now for something completely different.
In fact, I had a guy from Australia who got married to his wife, and she walked down the aisle to Amity.
Wow,
yeah, man. He sent me the clip of it, and it was a proper goosebump moment. That's like one of the most important times in your lives as a couple, and you've picked something that obviously resonates with them. But yeah, wrote that at home on an acoustic guitar that was given to me by my parents when I was 18 years old, just letting my emotion come out in those six strings. I mean, to see that is just humbling.
Probably not what you were expecting when you wrote that song.
No, I think it's probably the only one of my songs ever that could be used for that. But I was just absolutely blown away and honored that they'd chosen that special.
After leaving I Killed a Prom Queen, and I can only imagine probably feeling pretty disheveled after the fact, you know, leaving Australia and heading back to the UK, what were you looking for? What were you hoping for with regards to following your dreams and the continued pursuit of music?
That was definitely a weird time for me. Yeah, moving back home, obviously I was still in contact. A couple of the guys who played in Eternal Lord also played in The Hunt for Rider Wave. So yeah, long story short, we got put on as a support for Prom Queen when they were over in the UK. Playing in The Hunt for Rider Wave, that was how those guys came across me and how we kind of met. So I was obviously still in contact with a couple of the guys when I was over in Australia. They had grand ideas of getting signed to bigger labels and doing bigger and better things. Their vocalist at the time was planning on leaving to pursue another career. So yeah, I was missing out on way too much at home and not having that time or allowed that opportunity to go home for, you know, important things that were pre-planned years in advance. It was there in the pipeline to go home and further explore that, really. It was a coincidence of timing, but it all kind of went hand in hand quite nicely.
Say if Eternal Lord's opportunity didn't present itself and essentially fall into place at that point in time of your life, do you think that you would have had the heart or the energy to continue pursuing music, or would you have maybe been too disheartened to keep going on?
I knew that I hadn't been able to creatively do what I wanted to do in Prom Queen, and the recording process for that in Sweden. I was quite guided on how they wanted it to sound, and they were comparing it to other Australian bands and what they were doing. So it wasn't the most creative of experiences. I knew there was at least an album in me that I could write with the proper amount of aggression and emotion that I needed to put down in music. I think one way or another, something would have happened. What that would have been and how that would have looked, I'm not too sure. I hadn't quite finished.
Aside from Eternal Lord having plans for bigger and better things and coming into the band with that momentum, what else was appealing for you with regards to joining?
Obviously, I knew the way that Chris worked. Myself and Chris went years back at the time. We were good friends, and I knew how he worked, and our style of writing went really well together. It was good to work with those guys again. Both of the guitarists were guitarists in The Hunt for Rider Wave. I kind of knew how they worked together. I knew that if I wrote something, I could pass it on and they'd portray it as it should. They had already had a setup with Stu McKay, who was previously drummer in a band called Burning Skies. Stu is an absolute machine on drums.
Yeah, man. Stu's drumming is one of my favorite things about the album.
Yeah, it's just insane. So I was excited to play and write with him as well. And of course, he's a mixer and producer with his own studio. So that was all on tap and at hand as well. It all just went really nicely together. So I was definitely excited to jump on board with that and see what we could create.
Well, it must have felt so nice to not only be back in your home country, but to have such a positive and seamless transition into that next chapter of your musical journey.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. It felt like it was just a matter of time and those paths end up crossing, and it was all just sort of perhaps mapped and planned.
Yeah, that's really amazing to hear, man. I'm happy that that was the case.
Yeah.
Now, how far were the band into the writing of Blessed Be This Nightmare when you joined?
I think maybe one or two songs, there was some main riff lines written that Chris had come up with. From there on, it was just a case of me and him just pretty much sitting in the studio and just writing and writing and writing for days on end, playing around with different ideas. And it was just a case of, well, we'll just sit down and there's no, oh, it's going to be too heavy, it's not going to get played on the radio. Some singing bits in it because that appeals to the younger kids, and again it'll get radio play. And it was just about just making something as nasty and as heavy as we could make it. It was a good writing experience. I remember it being good fun. The thing I'd lacked and the thing I really missed when I joined Bong Queen is that everything was so serious. It was more of a business than a band. It was all just about money making, and it kind of took away from that passion of just writing actually what you wanted to write, and that's what I'd missed and I'd been sort of looking for.
I'm just thinking about it now. On top of all of that, it must have also felt so amazing to write riffs again, especially since that's where everything was essentially birthed from, you and your guitar.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And by this stage, did you just have like this massive stockpile of riffs ready to go?
Yeah, there was definitely a couple of things. There's a couple of riffs within that album that I probably had written for years. that didn't stop when I lived over in Oz for the time that I did. I was still picking up a guitar and just writing stuff. So yeah, it was good to be able to actually put some use to some bits that I had sort of tucked away.
I'd really love to talk a heap more about your vocals because it had such an impact on me back then and definitely on the scene.
No way.
I don't know if you realize the extent of that impact. Your voice was my gateway into really exploring that genre some more and enjoying it for the period of time in which I did.
Oh, awesome. I still get absolutely mind blown when people message me or say things like that. I'm just like, wow. It even shocks me that, you know, 2008 until now, people are still playing Eternal Lord on Spotify and, you know, messaging me and talking about it or tagging me because they're listening to it at the gym. It's still so crazy and mind blowing and humbling that people still think that's amazing, and what I was able to put down has sort of stood up for that long. Really cool. Really cool.
What did you set out to achieve this time around with your vocal performance on Blessed Be This Nightmare, and what did you hope to come out with on the other side?
I guess just my true voice. What I've been working for so long to find something that was most natural, but at the same time writing that, there was definitely a lot of, you know, anger there. I was definitely pissed off. I definitely knew I had more to give, more than I was previously allowed to put down in Prom Queen. Again, a different vibe from where I was in myself with the Hunt for Rider Wave. I guess I just wanted to put it down how it was, my voice in its sort of most raw and natural form, and just try and convey and get the aggression down and get it timestamped.
I'm gonna take you to the bank, Senator Trent. To the blood bank.
Okay, so do you feel you achieved that?
Yeah, I think so.
Cool, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like I sit there and it's on my weekly playlist or anything like that. but the few times I've gone back and gone, oh, it's been a while, I'll listen through to that.
Well, we'll just tell your mother that we ate it all.
So while I have you, it's a little random, but the second track and the first song I ever heard from you guys is elegantly titled Get to Fuck. Is that British slang? What does it mean?
Essentially, fuck off.
Yeah, okay, I thought as much.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some good meaning behind those lyrics.
Yeah, I'm sure I can connect the dots.
I think you'll be able to. Yeah, there's been a few times where I've gone, oh wow, yeah, that was heavy for the time, or oh shit, I remember that lyric. Yeah, that was angry.
The album itself was recorded at Studio 6 in Swindon, UK. What are some memories you have from the recording experience or the band lineup and its chemistry?
Yeah, it was a cool recording experience. There was a few times I can remember laying down the lyrics once we'd finished the actual recording of the album, the instrument parts. I can remember putting some lines down and listening to them back on the headphones, or going back into the mixing room and listening to them and going, I don't sound as pissed off as the lyric is. So I'd go back in and I'd know there was something more I could give that line or that intro or something like that. Even to the memory of just sitting in the studio on my own when we were recording Amity and just writing and playing that piece on my acoustic guitar, which I still own to this day. Yeah, cool memories of recording that.
You mentioned the anger of your lyrics. Where did a lot of your lyrical inspiration actually stem from?
Well, I guess it's probably a mixture of things. Inner thoughts and feelings of either battles with myself, or it might have been relationship stuff at the time. Obviously, it kind of coincided nicely that after leaving Prom Queen, there was a lot of shit that was being spoken on their behalf about me. I think the bitterness that I'd left and things weren't as easy as they portrayed they would be able to just get somebody else to replace me and continue as they were. Mm. Yeah, that fueled me and just gave me that perfect recipe that I needed at the time.
I mean, one could even argue that a lot of the lyrical content on Blessed Be This Nightmare is quite horror-like.
Yeah.
It's definitely very visceral and gory, and there's an element of brutality within it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Talking to you now and your general energy and nature, I'm kind of here thinking, where does this all actually come from?
There's always things in our minds where a certain situation you can think about that maybe makes you angry or provokes thought or a certain feeling about something. And I guess that's where my head goes in those situations with those thoughts and feelings. And yeah, it's a difficult one, but I guess sometimes you need to blank everything else out, listen to the music and see if that sparks any feelings or any emotion. Or it might be that you're thinking about a certain thing at that time, coupled with the music, and again, another hand-in-hand moment where your thoughts can start spiraling. It's an interesting thing to look back on. And again, people that have reached out and spoken to me about how that album or my lyrics or voice has helped them, which is in itself completely mind-blowing. But I think a lot of people have struggled with their mental health, and especially being a male. You know, I've experienced it myself with mental health problems and issues and my own demons and battles since around 2019 now. Regardless of that, it's cool to take time to look back and reflect. To be able to let out those demons and those issues that we might keep tucked away. They do need to see the light of day. It's a coping mechanism. It's how we take ourselves off and give ourselves 10 minutes to regroup in our own thoughts, to calm themselves. Mm. Hearing that from other people that have felt that they've been able to do that to things that I've written, so humbling, but also just such a clear and stark reminder that what we go through in our own minds is sometimes 10 times worse than what we portray or what we allow people to see. The importance of being able to be open with that, I think, is massive now, especially after, you know, what happened to Sean, for instance.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Yeah, and I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking to wake up to messages from people saying, hey, have you heard about Sean? Have you heard about Sean? I'm like, well, what the hell's gone on?
It's definitely a huge loss, especially those that didn't know him personally, just like myself. It did seem so unexpected. So like you said, you just never know what's going on inside. I met Sean in Brisbane once after a prom queen show because I had purchased in a bidding war a street-sized poster for music for the recently deceased, and I was able to come pick it up after a show and meet everyone back in 2008. And it was a really nice experience. But yeah, we just have no idea at the end of the day what each of us are actually going through.
Completely.
Yeah, just love to say rest in peace, Sean.
Yeah, real shame. And I think it's something we need to be able to express, and we need to be able to talk, and we need to have that safe space, even if it's 10 minutes to ourselves, to be able to regroup and say, right, I need to get my head in line and know what my next move's going to be, whether that be to speak to somebody or not make that irrational decision. And I think music is a gateway for that, a powerful platform for people to be able to sit back within themselves and just take that moment, really.
It can definitely act as a gateway, and on top of that, it can also just let you know that you're not alone in thinking and feeling those things. There can be a lot of comfort in that, I think.
Definitely, 100%.
It's not always easy to speak up and share certain parts of yourself in front of people, so thank you for doing that. I know it can be such a vulnerable thing to do.
No, honestly, it's absolutely fine. Pleasure.
And something I sometimes think about is if music can help you articulate some of your thoughts and feelings, then maybe please don't be afraid to reach out and talk to someone in your life so you can then bring those thoughts and feelings out there into your reality with your loved ones.
What if she rang us out just once?
Can't rain all the time.
I think it was a fitting title for the album, being blessed with this nightmare. Like you said, I guess almost like horror-like, that's where my train of thought was with quite a lot of the lyrics of certain situations or certain things or certain people being nightmares and how I would deal with that if I was in a nightmare.
Yeah, I love exploring this because I often find myself wondering why I'm so attracted to the intense emotional darkness in a lot of this music. And listening to music provides me that safe space to explore or connect with these thoughts and feelings.
Yeah, like I said, that's a really good way of describing it. It's almost like a safe space and safe place to be able to explore and dig a bit deeper into personal feelings. Yeah, I think that couldn't be a truer word, really. Whether it's you're sat on your own with the lyrics in front of you, reading through someone else's lyric or emotion and going, I can relate to that, or cross-referencing it and transferring something into your own thoughts or feelings.
Keep my hands busy. Yeah. That actually makes sense.
This really reminds me of a particular encounter I had with Daryl Palumbo from Glassjaw. I was lucky enough to meet him after a show. It was a Soundwave Festival sideshow in Melbourne with an amazing lineup: Dillinger Escape Plan, Glassjaw, and Dur on Grey. And so, I mean, a long story short, I had the Glassjaw logo tattooed on my side. And when meeting Daryl, awesome, I asked him to sign it and then went on this spiel about when everything you've ever wanted to know about Silence was released. I connected with it so much to the extent that I really, truly believed it was an album lyrically written by me, as if someone had racked my teenage brain and written an album on my behalf. And I remember this as clear as day. He just looked at me when I was done in silence for a moment and then said with all sincerity, "Man, I'm really sorry to hear that." It really stuck with me, because then and there, in that moment, I quickly realized that in no way did I resonate or connect with the actual words and themes of Daryl's work. They were his own, and his own story. In that instant, I quickly realized that I connected with his emotion, the vulnerability, and the delivery of those emotions.
You're talking to me all wrong. It's the wrong tone.
That's it, yeah, and that gave you an emotive sort of genre of how it made you feel at the time. But yeah, I mean, I guess that's the thing about art, it's so almost open to interpretation. Whether it be art in its form as you hang on the wall, or music or poetry or whatever, I just think it's, like we said right at the start, it's just so powerful, so powerful.
Yeah,
he obviously wrote that album in a certain space or a certain time within himself, which by the sounds of things wasn't so great.
You either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
A lot of the time we can be our own harshest critic. How does it work when you're then also producing? I mean, how do you call yourself out if you're not delivering the goods? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How did you and drummer Stuart McKay actually take on that role?
Chris Gregory had a good part to play in it as well. Mind you, saying that, fair being fair, we all kind of had our own ideas and a chip in to say what we thought production-wise. I don't really remember it being a stressful time. It wasn't a tedious, it wasn't a stressful part of this whole process. We were all quite open in being able to say, that was a crap idea. We can come up with something better. Knowing that most people would be listening to whatever you do on back then, listening to it on CD in a car or something like that. So it'd be a case of just burning it off and just all going for a drive and just cranking it up in a car and seeing, you know, is that how we imagine somebody's going to grab hold of this album and go, yeah, that's super heavy and that's sounding exactly right. An overwhelming idea in my head, which I still remember to this day, of what that should sound like. Having known the guys for so long and the other guys just being an instant sort of connection with, it was one of the first times I think I've been in a band and there was harmony amongst everyone, as in we knew that the songs we'd written were how we wanted them to sound. All the parts fit together, and it was then you get it down recorded. And like you said, the challenging part of production is being able to make sure you portray it and everybody else hears it the way that you envision it being heard. When we handed it over to Golf, the label we were signed to at the time, they were really happy with it. Yeah. It was really cool, the support we had both from Golf and a guy called Darren Toms from Golf Records at the time, who's now with sort of labels such as Candlelight.
Okay, so two-parter. What is your favorite song from Blessed Be This Nightmare, both musically and then also vocally?
Oh, wow.
yeah, it's a tough one.
I think musically, there's some awesome guitar work and awesome drumming in both Set Your Anchor and O Brothel Where Art Thou. Vocally, I guess, Eye the Deceiver and Blessed Be This Nightmare. Uh-huh. Yeah, there's so many. It's one of those things, it sounds weird to sort of say it yourself, really. I'm just sat here grinning. But thinking back to the album, I mean, even looking at the front cover artwork, the guys over at Sons of Nero came up with that on a concept that I was like, I just want a small kid terrified under his duvet, not wanting to peek out from what he might see. And somehow they got inside my head and just put down exactly what I had. And I just remember seeing it going, wow, you've nailed it.
Oh, yeah, that must have felt amazing.
Yeah, definitely. There's so many cool things. Mm. And everybody in the band at the time bought their something that made it unique.
Something to the album. I don't know what genre you would even call Eternal Lord, but there is something definitely unique about the overall sound of this band and album. And there were obviously bits and pieces probably taken from all over the place, which then created Blessed Be This Nightmare.
Yeah.
With Life is Peachy, I really, really enjoy putting my time and energy into pursuing albums and artists that really resonate with me either from back then or something that has inspired me now. So your voice and its place on this album has really stuck with me. It's an honor to celebrate 15 years of it.
Even yourself saying that, I'm just like, wow, people honestly think that. And it's so cool to even be able to have made that impression upon somebody or have helped somebody out a situation or a certain song that resonates with them for a certain reason or a time that they're going through. It's unreal. But I guess if somebody came up to me and said, Eternal Lord, Blessed Be This Nightmare, I don't know what that is. I would be like, yeah, me neither. Like you said, I wouldn't want to say it's metal. I wouldn't want to say it's metalcore. I wouldn't want to say it's hardcore.
My name is Dave. I like to party.
I think the target of just sitting down and writing heavy songs that we thought sounded good kind of just ended up like that.
Yeah, well, I think if you can't genreify something, that's probably a good thing in my eyes.
Yeah.
I'm just looking it up on Wikipedia now, and it says deathcore.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, well, that's because it has to say something, right? Do you remember how you felt about what you had created on the eve of the actual album's release, knowing the experience you guys had just had making it together?
Knowing, and again to this day, it's the one thing I've released which I'm still really proud of. I think it's the best thing that my name's ever been associated with musically. So there was the excitement knowing how much hard work we've put into it, but also how natural the process was. It was really exciting to be able to, you know, walk into HMV and just see it there on the shelves, thinking we never set out to try and be the biggest band in the world. We never set out to try and be the heaviest band in the world. We literally just wanted to write heavy music and just see what happened with it. It was never treated as a business. It wasn't about any money. It was really cool to reap the rewards of that, which was having people message us, speak to us, book us for shows, come out to shows, buy the album. It was crazy and mind-blowing to all of us, really.
Wow.
That was a first for me, too.
Soon after Blessed Be This Nightmare's release, Eternal Lord called it a day. And yeah, I have to say, after hearing about such an overwhelmingly positive experience coming together as a band and creating your debut album, which was also so well received by fans and the label. What factors actually led up to that critical decision to leave Eternal Lord once you were finally in this really nice, sweet spot? Because, you know, after hearing everything on paper, it now doesn't really seem to make any sense.
It was a strange one, really. We'd been booked for a couple of European shows and we'd been over and done that. And then we'd been signed to Barrett Music in the USA.
Oh man, which was just an amazing label with such an epic roster of bands at the time.
Oh, so cool. Yeah, I remember thinking, wow, this has got literally some of my favorite bands on. That was just like a highlight moment for me.
Yeah, man, for sure.
And they booked us on a big American tour. I think it was supporting the Acacia Strain. I remember thinking this will be so cool. And I was excited to get back over to America and tour and all the rest of it. But those couple of European shows we played, our drummer at the time had expressed how...
Stuart McKay?
Yeah, expressed how jet lagged he was and how he's got a real genuine phobia of flying in planes and all the rest of it. So the thought of flying over to America and touring literally crippled him. Point where he was like, look, I'm going to leave the band because you guys are going to go on to do those kind of things. He just couldn't bring himself to do it.
It's really unfortunate to hear, man.
Yeah, we were going to be looking for another drummer, and of course Stu was such a machine behind the kit. There was no way from a small town in Wiltshire where we were from that we were going to be able to replace him easily. It was never going to be the case. Then you think, well, we're going to end up being split members from across the country because we're going to have to find somewhere London-based or something like that. And it all just started going a little bit from there, thinking, don't know how we're going to do this.
The number you dialed is not in service.
And it was around that time that I'd applied and been accepted to join the emergency services as a firefighter. So again, it was another one of those things where it was just like, I think it's time.
Not in my movie.
There comes a certain point with music and what you're doing, you either have to try and earn a living out of it and turn it into a job and a business. And my experience of that wasn't a nice one at all. And it's not something I wanted for Eternal Lord, and it's not something I wanted to go through again.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, it was time to hang up the mic lead and move on.
I have to sleep with one eye open for the rest of your life.
Give a shit about sleeping, Leo.
I mean, yeah, it's quite the whirlwind between the few years of Ida Wave through Prom Queen to Eternal Lord, but a lot was actually accomplished, and even though the end was bittersweet, the ending at least was of a positive band experience.
Yeah, definitely.
And so what about Stuart? Did he go on to continue drumming locally or nationally, or did he transition more into that studio and producing side of things?
As far as I know, he stopped playing in bands and just focused on his own recording studio and mixing and producing, which I think to date he still has. I think he's leveled up in regards to sort of his own studio and things like that. He used to go under Studio 6. I'm not too sure if he still does. But yeah, as far as I know from speaking to Nick, the bass player, rather than sort of playing himself and touring, he's just switched over to that side of things and by all accounts probably doing really well.
please correct me if I have any details wrong here, as I was following this, I think, via MySpace back in the day, while, of course, living in Australia. But after Eternal Lord, you and Chris continued to release music for a hot minute as a two-piece studio band under the Hunt for Idlewave. I remember at least, yeah, there being one new song online or something.
You can never stop writing. I still write now. I think we'd written that song just hanging out and messing around on guitars and stuff. We were like, that kind of reminds me or kind of sits where I'd envision the Hunt for Idlewave would have gone.
Would you say that maybe it was some sort of closure on Idlewave and that chapter of your life?
Yeah, I guess so. We were just like, hey, let's just record it, keep it raw, not intend to really sort of push it or do anything with it, but it's just cool to be able to feel something, be proud of it, or to think that it is something yourself, and then just have that platform to share it and see if others think it's cool as well.
So happy when I came across that after Eternal Lord. It was just so great, man, to hear more music from you.
Thank you.
Do you feel you would ever return to anything like that, even if it was just studio work?
Yeah. Yeah. I've got a couple of mates who are still in bands and still touring, and a couple of guys I still speak to who work for record labels and things like that. I kind of loosely say whenever we have a catch-up or a chat that, you know, if you hear of anyone wanting to start anything or anything that crops up that you think would fit the bill, then just to give me a shout and let me know. Because I think it would be definitely something I would mull over. What my voice would sound like these days, I've got no idea. It would definitely be cool to explore that. Put 15 years worth of thoughts, feelings and emotions back down into something aggressive.
That would be something. And like you said, with the 15 years more life experience.
That's it. Yeah.
Those listening, now you've heard it. Someone make that damn call. But seriously, man, that would be actually amazing, because your voice is something special. And in my opinion, was at the forefront of absolutely everything back then. And so after feeling a little uninspired for a period of time, I kind of fell in love with vocals all over again after hearing you back then.
Thank you.
Do you follow the scene these days and the evolution of vocals and vocalists that are within it?
Do you know what? I was thinking about this the other day, because I actually went and saw a band play up in Manchester in the UK, and I don't know whether it was a fear of missing out or a fear of me maybe questioning my life decisions at the time, but I kind of just switched off. I continued to carry on listening to the bands that I loved and I'd always been listening to, but as far as the scene goes, I literally was somehow able to just flick a switch and just turn off from it.
Well, what are you gonna do? Life's a bitch and then you die, right?
Sometimes life's a bitch and then you keep living.
I think part of that was that I didn't want to see it in my face all the time and think, oh, damn, I shouldn't have made that decision. I should still be touring, or I should still be in a band and all that kind of stuff. I think I just had to, at that time, focus on building something personal and moving on from a few things, really, and just kind of focus on who I was without music or without a band. I don't think I'll ever be without music. Here we go. I've got a couple of mates that play in bands that are awesome, but I don't really follow the scene or know much about new bands that are out there. I stumble across a few. Probably, like I said, there's just a couple of bands that my mates are in. I'll support them back.
Okay, my friend, try and experience what I'm about to chirp in your lobes, okay, cool?
I
Having a glimpse into the scene within Australia at the time, how did it compare or contrast to what was going on back home in the UK?
Probably hard to compare because I guess it was on different levels. Pom Queen were obviously a bigger band than Eternal Lord, but they were also a very, what I would call mainstream, in it for the money kind of band. It was all about making it mainstream. So you'd have like 14, 15 year old kids turning up at shows, and that was like a target audience for them because they know they'd buy the merch and that kind of stuff. Whereas Eternal Lord was just, let's just write some angry, loud, pissed off music and see who likes it. So there were definitely two different levels of platform. Playing the bigger shows in Pom Queen and stuff was cool, but they're not as personable as smaller, intimate shows with a few hundred people at. Know all the words to your songs and want to grab the mic off you. And yeah, two different levels. I was quite happy with the way things were and what things looked like in the Eternal Lords era. There was all sorts of other bands cropping up at the time. Again, we're influenced by different bands and didn't sound like anything I was aiming for with Eternal Lord, but cool, heavy bands nonetheless. But the UK scene kind of dipped and peaked. That's the way I kind of felt it went anyway. What it's like now, I've got no idea.
Sometimes to love someone, you gotta be a stranger.
As you know, there's a couple of big bands from the UK with, you know, your likes of Bring the Horizon. We played some shows with fans like that when we were in the Hunt for Rider Wave, the likes of sort of Gallows and Enter Shikari.
I love thinking back to those days when bands of that size were playing shows to hundreds of kids in clubs. Sometimes it's easy to forget, right?
Yeah, that's so cool.
And if you follow a band on that journey, that's also such a crazy connection to have with them and the music.
Yeah.
So in saying that, with the 15 years of retrospect, where does Blessed Be This Nightmare and your time in Eternal Lord sit with you now, personally and creatively?
Especially the Eternal Lord and Hunt for Rider Wave sort of times. There's a lot of fond memories and a lot of things I achieved that I never thought I would achieve. And as a kid, you know, started playing music at 8 years old. I remember laying in bed at night worrying about what I was going to do when I grew up, because all I wanted to do was play music. I never wanted to have a Monday to Friday 9 to 5. I didn't want to just fall in line and do what was expected. And I remember genuinely being fearful of what I would do as a career and what I'd do when I grew up. For the most part, I look back and, like you said, I was like, that's actually cool to, you know, be able to say I did that 15 years on from Blessed Be This Nightmare, and people still listen to it. Personally and creatively, I think it's the best thing I've ever put my stamp on within my time within music and playing in bands and things like that. It's definitely the thing I'm most proud of. Probably the only thing that I'd sit back, apart from some of the old Ida Wave stuff for old time's sake. But that album was something I can now and again listen to, and I'm happy to sort of take the time and talk to people when they randomly crop up and ask now and again.
You're not mad?
No, man. I can't tell you, that was one of the best times I ever had. It was.
It's still angry, it's still pissed off. It still sounds and holds up as a heavy album, despite what bands have moved on to sort of sounding like and all the rest of it.
For,
I mean,
sure.
It's mind-blowing that it's 15 years. And again, taking myself back to that small town of Swindon and thinking we're just, you know, sitting around writing heavy music, it's cool.
Lauren, I want to know you.
What does that mean? Know me. Know me. Nobody knows anyone else, ever. You will never, ever know me.
It gives me time to listen to some of those lyrics and reflect on those times in my life and think back to those times and how I felt in that moment. And it's all good memories. The only person I still speak to from the band, and that's not through fallouts or anything, that's just through...
life.
Drifting apart and life, yeah. I've recently spoke to Nick. We kind of touched back and I said I had this coming up, and it was almost 15 years, and yeah, crazy, crazy. T
to be able to come and release something like that in the UK and be home and experience that sort of touring life with those guys, something I'll carry with me and cherish. Hopefully it's not the last time I'll put something like that down on record.
Don't get my hopes up, man.
If the right thing comes along, I'll be back.
And the right timing, I guess.
That's it. Yeah, definitely.
Well, congratulations on 15 years of an album that you're also so proud of. That's just icing on the cake, I reckon. And thank you for your contribution towards vocals. Honestly, man, it's been a pleasure to listen to you over the years.
Thanks for giving me an excuse to think back and listen back. Yeah, it's been a good trip.
Happy to hear. Yeah, yeah. Big thank you for your time and energy and trusting to come on to the Life is Peachy podcast.
Oh no, it's an absolute pleasure. Yeah, absolute pleasure. Thanks for reaching out and for thinking of me.
Yeah, looking forward to doing the album and your stamp on the scene proud, man.
I'm sure you will, man. I'm sure you will.
And until then, I think I'm gonna blast the album and do some air guitar, some air vocals now.
Awesome. I think I'll have to play it on my commute to work this week.
I love this job.
And there we have it, episode 23 of the Life is Peachy podcast, my chat with Ed Butcher, and 15 years of Eternal Lords, blessed be this nightmare. Next up, of course, we have episode 24, but who and what will that be? You can always head over to the Patreon, where there are a bunch of perks, including early guest and album reveal, additional episode content, and if there are questions you've always wanted to ask some of your favorite artists, now there's a way. I feature questions from patrons in my episodes, and they can be submitted to me exclusively through patreon.com/lifeispeachypodcast.
The Life is Peachy podcast is not monetized.
Any love over a Patreon really does help to make the necessary time that is required to write, record, and edit these episodes on top of my full-time work with Her Name is Murder.
What do you want? What do you want?
It's not that simple.
What do you want? What do you want?
More support means more time, and for you guys, more episodes.
It's science.
And while I have you, don't forget about the Second Lip podcast. That is, of course, the Life is Peachy mixtape sessions. What? I'm building that one up this year. There are already episodes waiting for you over there as you pass the time between now and episode 24. Track 3 is with producer Gigi Garth Richardson, the amazing man responsible for albums from Rage Against the Machine, Kitty, Spine Shank, 40 Blow Summer, and Mudvayne's LD50.
Beyond a shadow of a doubt, that was the hardest record that I have ever made. The most difficult because the music was so intense. It was so fucking intense. But worth it, proud of it. I think that's a great record.
Oh, there's nothing like that album, let alone in the band's back catalog. like that album.
Exactly. We took 4 days to get that bass out.
Track 4 is joined by none other than Silent Civilian, Spine Shank main man Johnny Santos, and ex-Crazy Town frontman Brett Epic Mazer jumps in on track 5. Looking back over 20 years of Dark Horse and his life before, during, and after Crazy Town.
This is Crazy Town. Crazy Town.
And maybe this is your first time checking out Life is Peachy, and if you also happen to enjoy a lot of nu metal related releases and artists, then there are a stack of episodes waiting for you on this main channel. Each episode features a guest from the album of discussion, so jump into that time machine and check it out for yourself. I hope you have fun with them.
Welcome to the party, pal!
Until we hang out again, I would love this chance to say a very big thank you for spending your time and energy with me today. I really do appreciate it. It means so much to me, and I hope you also had a great time.
Did you like it?
Big love to you all. Have an amazing day.
See you at the party, Richter.
Bye-bye.
You know, I can eat a peach for hours.
Mm.
This episode was written, edited, and produced by myself. Recorded from the comfort of my own home.
DIY style.
With each guest calling in from wherever they happen to be around the world at that particular time. The Life is Peachy theme song is an original tune for this podcast, written by Tim Richardson.
The Life is Peachy podcast is not monetized. All music rights and credits go to its rightful owners.
Further details can be found in the description of the specific episode. All artwork is original and illustrated for the Life is Peachy podcast by Chris Lisa Liefding.